Today is June 5th, 2019, and I am with Mr. J.D. Kugler, who is a Polk Countyan World War II veteran. My name is Joyce Johnston, and I'm with the Polk County Historical Commission. Mr. Kugler also serves with me on that commission. Today we're going to talk about his time in the armed services during World War II. And I've asked him to start with the time that he spent at the U.S. Capitol before the World War II started and what he was doing on the day Pearl Harbor was bombed. Mr. Kugler?
Okay, I graduated from Livingston High School in May. And the next day after I graduated, I went to Washington, D.C. to take a job as elevator operator in the House of Representatives. And this all came about through my congressman. And I was in, went to school. First of all, I took about a 6 month course in architectural drafting. Prior to starting my schooling, I was going to George Washington University, and I had just gotten started good when the war started. But to go back a little bit further, the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed, that was a Sunday morning, I was going through the Smithsonian Institute looking at the museum. Spent the morning there, and I came back around noon, ate lunch there in town, and I went to a movie. And when I came out of the movie, well, the newsboys was all hollering extra, extra, and about Pearl Harbor. So I bought a paper right away to see what was going on, found out. But anyhow, I went on back home. My apartment, and I was living with an aunt and uncle then. And I might say this movie was just diagonally across the street from the White House. Well, actually, the Treasury Department was between the White House and 15th Street where I was. And the next day, I went on to the Capitol to go to work. I knew that everything was going to be real important then. Because that was the day that they were going to declare war. I didn't know they were going to, but they did. And it was real busy, a lot of activity in the Capitol. And I believe it was that afternoon they started putting soldiers on guard at the doors. I know the next day when I went to work, they had soldiers at all of the doors at the Capitol you had to go by. And it continued on that way all during the time I was there. After that,
okay, well, how long did you remain at the Capitol before you joined the service?
Well, I worked at the Capitol up until the semester at George Washington ended sometime around first year, February maybe, and then took leave from the Capitol and came back to Livingston because I knew I was going to be inducted, and I stayed here about maybe a month before I went in. I went in on March the 8th, 1943, I believe is the day I went in. And
where did you do your basic training?
I went to, first from Livingston, I went to San Antonio to Fort Sam Houston. And from there, they sent me to basic training at Wichita Falls and went through basic there. And from the basic training, I went to Amarillo to the Air Force Mechanics School for B-17s. And was it there until about sometime in the end of November. and went to, from there to Las Vegas, because I know I was in Las Vegas for Christmas. And that was gunnery school. And gunnery school finished up in the springtime of 44. And from there I went to a crew training down in Tampa, Florida. And we trained there about, I think, about 3 months before we went overseas. But then, we left to go overseas. I left Tampa about August 26th or 27th, went to Savannah, Georgia, and we picked up a new airplane to take over. We thought it was going to be ours, but we found out later we just ferrying it over. And we left Savannah on August the 29th, 1943, which was my birthday. And I was 21 years old the day I left to go over. And the plane we had was brand new, just like a new car. You could smell the new in it. And shine like a pretty penny. And we were real proud of it. We thought it was ours. And in the loading of the plane, we had two or three large toolboxes we thought was going to be ours, radio tools, mechanic tools, everything. And then in the bomb bay, it was loaded down with some crates of K-rations and bundles of winter parkers. And we didn't know where we were going, especially carrying all those winter parkers with us. But we went from Savannah, we flew up to New Hampshire, Grenier Field, New Hampshire, and we spent the night there. We had a cracked radio room hatch door that had to be repaired. And then from there, we flew to Bangor, Maine, picked up some orders, I believe it was, and went on to Labrador, Goose Bay, Labrador, spent the night there. And from Goose Bay, we flew over Iceland to, over Greenland to Iceland, spent the night in Iceland, and had to pull a 25-hour inspection on the plane while I was there. That's how I knew it was. And from Iceland, we flew across to Valley Wales, spent the night there, and the next day we left the train and went to Beatty Hall, England. That was where it was a replacement depot for the 8th Air Force. So we were assigned first to the 8th Air Force, and we were in England about 3 weeks, I guess it was, and then we caught a plane down to London, and from London we went on down to Newquay, England, which is down at Land's End of England. And then we flew by Air Transport Command from there to Casablanca, North Africa, and that was in a converted B-24 that we flew that. And then from Casablanca, we flew to Tunis. And from Tunis, we went across to Naples, Italy. We spent the night in Naples, and that was quite an experience for us. And from Naples, we went out to a little village airport from town, a few miles, and spent the night there. I believe the name of the town was Gioia, Italy, and spent the night there. And then a old beat up B-17 came down to pick us up, and you can tell that it had a lot of time on it because it was almost a wreck and it war weary. And we loaded our bags in it and flew up to a little place called Stepperoni, Italy. And that was our air base, the 483rd Bomb Group. And when I landed there, I knew I was in the combat area then. And so that was where I spent the next 9 or 10 months, I forget which it was, flying my missions. And you want me to go ahead and...
Right, so I know that you're still really close with a lot of your crew members that were with you then. Were these crew members guys that flew with you from the very beginning? I mean, were part of your crew from the very beginning?
All my crew members are dead now. Okay. But in my bomb group, we have an organization, and some of us stayed together at those reunions. For this is be my 26th year, I believe, to go and continues. Mm-hmm. And when I first started in the bomb group after the war, there's three of us that attended all the time, but they're all gone too now.
Okay.
But I'm still going, and the next one will be in September up to Dallas. And our bomb group has gone down to where we don't have enough of just our reunion. So we're combining with 10 groups of B-24s. So we'll be meeting in September.
Okay. But I just wondered if these were guys that started with you in the very beginning, you know.
Yes, from training. I got with this 10-man crew in Florida
when we
left to go overseas, and we stayed together all the way through the war.
Okay, that was what I was wondering.
Yeah.
So you built quite a...
You get pretty close to some guys when you live in a little pyramid tent for, 9 months.
And so that's what you... That's what you were in, a little tent?
Yeah. And two of the guys left before we finished. They were shot down, and one was hit in the leg and thigh real bad. He was sent back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one was shot down and was picked up by the Russians, and they got him back, and he came directly back.
Okay.
And,
but you stayed at that one place, camp.
One air base. And when we got there, we were the last air group to go into Italy from the States. We were the youngest group over there. And our group went over in April of 44. April of 44. And they had been there about 4 months when I got there.
Okay.
I think the figures are right. And this was a new group. It moved into what was once a big wheat farm, sort of a commune or some type. And the headquarters was in the main owner's building. And our service club and PX and all that kind of stuff was in the stables and barns and stuff. And our church was a big silo that had to be cleaned out of hay. And it was just a perfect chapel because it was all brick, vaulted and everything. And it was real nice. But in the group, each had four squadrons to a group. And I was in the 817th squadron. And we had our own mess hall and everything. And it was, since we were in the Army Air Corps, we were under just like an Army. And we had a Army field kitchen, which was a tent and pretty rude type living. And we had outdoor latrines about 100 yards away. And the heat we had during the winter was a barrel with an outside barrel of 100 octane gasoline and a little tube run into this barrel dripping gas and burning. And once we lit it, it had stayed burning just like a torch or something. It got real hot in there. And course, we slept on cots, no mattress. We just folded up our heavy overcoat and everything for padding underneath. But we had a couple of blankets. We stayed warm, covered up with our other stuff too. And we had to carry water to the tent in a 5-gallon can. We washed and shaved out of a steel helmet the whole time I was there. And as far as the missions, each hour was usually anywhere from 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning. And we'd get up and go to the mess hall and eat and get everything ready. And then we would go down to the, what we call the line where the airplanes were in their separate parking spaces. And then the officers, they went to briefing, and the radio operator, navigator, bombardier, pilot and all. And then they'd come back to the plane, we'd check everything out, and then we'd wait for the tower to give us the go-ahead to taxi to get in formation. And all the planes would taxi one behind the other up to the end of the runway. When we first got there, it was a dirt runway, but later on we had a steel mat and used the dirt runway for emergency landing. And the planes took off at 30-second intervals. We'd go on, and sometimes we'd meet other groups to be a larger formation. But each group, our group, had 32 planes that we put up. Seven went to the target from each squadron, but we had one spare that we sent up that would turn around and come back if he wasn't needed. So actually 28 planes to a group went up. Yeah. And then the different groups would come together to make one large formation sometime. And most of my targets was from North Italy on into Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria, Germany, and Northern Italy, Yugoslavia. But the targets, the long ones, would last 7 or 8 hours, something like that. And we'd go up to altitudes. 31,500 is the highest I was on for actual bombing. And the temperature up there in an open airplane that way would get down to 50 or 60 degrees below zero. And we had to have on heated suits and gloves. Wow. And boots. And because if you touch bare metal with your bare hands, your hands would stick to the metal. And to back up a little bit, when we left to get on the plane, we went by the mess hall and picked up a little container that had a sandwich for each one of us, which was usually jelly and peanut butter, or marmalade and peanut butter. And then we had, four little containers of coffee. And that we'd use after we started back. But I get on back where I was now. Before we got the target, we turned on what they call the IP, which is initial point. And that was some point on the ground that the navigator and bombardier could focus the bomb sight on to set up for a straight run to the target from there. Because once we got on the bomb run, the bombardier controlled the plane through an automatic pilot, and he flew it across the target. As soon as we went across the target, we rallied to the left or the right, either one, whichever was briefed, and began to drop altitude real fast to get out of the flak. And point out what flak was. Everybody's heard of anti-aircraft flak. Well, we had two types, the 88 millimeter and the 105. The 88 was lower than the 105, and the 88 was black puffs, and the 105s were white puffs. And out beside, you'd see them pop up and see the burst of flak smoke, the black or something. Well, it looked scary, but when you see the smoke, it's already too late, because it's already done what it's going to do.
Yeah.
And, one of my first, I believe it was maybe sixth or seventh mission, and we were going to Vienna, and we got one of the engines got hit by flak, and it went out, and when it went out, we couldn't feather the prop on that engine. That means to turn it to where it doesn't catch any wind, it's straight with the wind and it won't windmill. But we couldn't feather it, and it kept windmilling, and no oil, it got hot, and the propeller broke off, and when it broke off, it went out and knocked number four engine out. So that meant that we just had two engines left on the left-hand side of the plane. So coming back, we had to drop the ball turret, and some people don't understand that you can drop the ball turret just by taking some bolts loose inside and letting it drop on down, which we did. We threw out everything in the plane that had any weight, the machine gun barrels and all that was heavy. We threw those out, threw all the ammunition out, even threw the radio operator's chair out. Just anything that had any weight we threw out. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have any trouble. We kept losing altitude all the way back, but we landed on two engines and everything was fine. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my first experiences of real combat.
And real danger. Mm-hmm. What was your job specifically?
I was an engineer and top turret gunner.
Okay, so you were a gunner.
Mm-hmm. And I stood, my position was standing between the pilot and the co-pilot and keeping my eye on the instruments when it went up in the turret. Uh-huh. And anything else that needed to be done. And transfer gas, like those two engines went out, we transferred the gas out of those tanks into another tank to be able to have plenty of gas.
Okay.
And
how many of you were on each one of those planes? How many?
10 of us.
10 on each plane?
Mm-hmm. Four in the front and six in the back. And the bombardier and navigator was up in the very nose of the plane, and the pilot, co-pilot, myself was in the cockpit. And then after you go through the bomb bay, on the other back part of the plane was a radio operator, and then the two waist gunners, and the ball turret gunner and the tail gunner. Mm-hmm. And we were hit by jet fighters. First time that the jet fighters were used over there in our Air Force in the 15th, and we were hit by those jet fighters. And they, on one mission, they knocked six planes out of our group one pass. And I was flying as a substitute on another crew that day. And our tail gunner on our crew was in one of the planes that went down, and then our bombardier was substituting in another plane, and his plane went down. So we had two of our crew went down that mission. And I flew one mission, night mission, and then the Air Force tried that, but it didn't work out too good of having what they call lone wolf missions. And that's when they sent single planes up at night to go to a target, And our group put up four planes, which is one from each squadron. And it was strictly voluntary. You had to volunteer for those. And my pilot was the operations officer of our squadron also. And our radio operator was up there that afternoon talking to him, and he was telling them they had that mission. It was a volunteer mission, and wondered if he wanted to go, you know. And he volunteered and said, thought I'd like to go also. So I volunteered too.
He volunteered you.
Yeah, so the radio operator and I both went on that night mission, and it was real interesting. We left about 10 o'clock at night, and we went to Bleckhammer, which is up in Czechoslovakia, and we dropped the bombs. But flying that for 8 hours, and everything on the plane was blacked out, even radio, the dials on the stuff in the cockpit was out, and they even had the dials on your watches. Didn't have those even. Didn't even look at any light after dark. But you got vertigo, I guess, the way you feel you're flying upside down. You didn't know which way you're going sometimes.
Oh, my goodness.
And coming back over Budapest, well, the searchlights were trying to get us. And when the light would hit across the plane, with the guys in the back in the way said that it was so bright that you could read a newspaper if you wanted to. Of course, you didn't have time, but it's that bright. But anyhow, we landed the next morning, right about daylight, and we just had enough to land. We didn't have enough gas left to taxi back to the taxi place when we got back. So that was close.
I guess.
Actually, we thought we were going to maybe have to ditch in the Adriatic, but the pilot decided he'd make it, and he made it on back, but we couldn't taxi. And
was that your only nighttime mission?
That was only they didn't have very many of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were there.
And
a good...
we lost one plane that night, too, which was a 24th of your planes, really.
Uh-huh. Well. Well, you were there a long time. Did you ever wonder, you know, if this was ever going to be over?
Yes and no. We knew that we were knocking all the oil refineries out, and they were getting down where there wasn't very many really in operation.
Okay.
And after we got down to a certain point, we started concentrating on the marshaling yards for transportation, because all the supplies they had to
move.
Transportation. And so we knew it was coming to an end, because the fire planes wasn't coming up at all hardly then. Didn't have the fuel for it. And
okay.
After the Battle of the Bulge, we were real busy then with the railroad yards, making sure we knocked out the big marshaling yards where all the traffic was going through, and also big railroad bridges. They concentrated on those some too. Mm-hmm. They were real hard to hit.
Okay. How did you get your news?
I didn't get a whole lot, but this is another thing. If you want to hear it, everything sort of makeshift for yourself what you did. But we found out how to make a radio that we had in the tent. We took a cigar box, and then we took half of a headset, just one part, and they took the face off and soldered a little needle right to the center of that little dial in the headset. Then we made a cone out of paper, like a paper cup, and sealed to that needle. And then down at the end of a tent row, a guy from the radio department had a radio out of a plane, and they ran a line up the back of the tents, and everybody that wanted to would hook onto that line. So whatever he could pick up over his radio out of the airplane Well, that's what we
heard.
That's
what you heard.
And that, you could hear that through that little box enough that you could hear it in the tent mm-hmm. that way.
Well, did you receive any mail from home or anything?
Oh, no. We were pretty regular, yeah.
You could get mail?
Yeah. It was V-mail, though.
What's...
It wasn't, you know what V-mail is?
Well, but tell us.
Okay. V-mail, where you write it on a special sheet of paper, and that sheet would go somewhere, and they'd make a microfilm of it. And that microfilm rolled, a whole row would hold probably thousands of letters.
Uh-huh.
And then it was sent back to the States, and when it got back to the States, they reproduced it into another letter to be mailed
back to
whoever it was going to.
Yeah. So, but you just received standard mail from home.
We received packages, but most of the mail I got was... Well, it was regular mail, mostly coming over this way,
uh-huh.
but going from us to home
right.
was all V-mail.
Right, okay. Know. But you were able to
hear
from
home. You might
get
several letters at one time, but we got pretty good mail service.
Oh, okay. All right, well, tell us about the food.
Well, sometimes it's real good.
Depending on the cook.
Yeah, well, we did cook some on our barrel there. We'd go down to the mess hall and get some Spam or something, and we'd buy eggs from the Italians, and we could have bacon Spam and eggs there, tin a few times. But we'd buy big bags of almonds already shelled, and we'd roast them on our thing. We had those things.
Mm-hmm.
But the food in the mess hall, it was decent. It was always Spam some way. Depends on how they wanted to make it, anything from fried to baked to anything. Any way they could make it, they used it. We had powdered eggs for breakfast. And we had bread, but it must have been made somewhere else and brought in, because they didn't have any baking facilities there in the tent,
mm-hmm.
mess hall tent, for a good while. And there's one time that we were short on food. They went to two meals a day for just a few days because the shortage of getting food from Naples to us, because a supply ship, I understand, had been torpedoed out there, or sunk out there in the harbor. Mm-hmm. And then after the boat was out there one time, well, all the labels were off the cans, and so we had a supply of sauerkraut for a few days.
Oh goodness. Yeah. But you were thankful for it.
Thankful for it.
Yeah.
But in all, I didn't starve. It was decent.
Yeah, it was not a
big
issue.
It wasn't most delicious, but...
But it sustained you.
Thanksgiving and Christmas, we had real good dinners.
Did you have much interaction with the local people where you were?
Not a whole lot. The Italians worked on base, a lot of them did.
Mm-hmm.
And we got acquainted with an old fellow that did work on our tent. We extended the walls out on it and poured us a thin concrete floor rather than a mud floor that we mm-hmm. had. And he invited us into a little town 4 miles away one day. And what we had to eat that night was anchovies from the Adriatic, fresh anchovies. And that's all I could do to eat them. You bite down and you could just taste the sand in them.
I guess.
And of course, we washed it down with some good vino,
I bet.
Vino was real cheap. You could buy a gallon for a quarter.
Oh, goodness.
But that little town, by the way, was an old town. It dated back to 400 and something, I believe, B.C.
B.C.?
B.C., and his old walled-in ceiling had a walled-in whole city. and a main entrance into town, a little narrow street, just barely wide enough for a cart to go down. You know. And we got acquainted with him pretty well. We visited him a couple of times.
How did you learn that your mission was done and that you were leaving?
Well, I kept track myself. Of course, they kept track in the operations officer office also. But every mission, I kept track in my little book. And so we looked forward to it. We knew it was coming to an end, but we just didn't know when because the activity had dropped off as far as the resistance and everything. And I finished my missions a couple of weeks before the war ended, so I was there when the war ended, waiting for orders to come back. And it was a real celebration that night. Different squadrons had different ways of celebrating. By then, you know, it was already spring and warm weather, and a lot of them in one of the squadrons gathered all the barrels of gasoline that was left over, piled them into a big pile, and shot them with an incendiary shell to set them fire and blew up. And big explosion. And in our group, someone would get a 5-gallon can of gasoline and run down the tent row, making a row of gasoline, and the other end somebody would throw a light to it, and you'd have an explosion going down the tent row. And it was quite a celebration.
I bet. Some more of that cheap vino was probably consumed.
That was flowing good down at the service club. I had a big business that night. But I go back a little bit further. As you finish missions, well, after every mission, we went to interrogation, where we sit down with the officer and tell them everything that we could remember seeing and all that. And then after you go through interrogation, you went outside. When you got through with interrogation, they give you 2 ounces of American whiskey. And at first, I didn't drink, but it got to where it tastes pretty good later on, after 35.
I guess, yeah.
And when you finish up, sometimes the guys would, you could have extras if you want them, they'd get extras. And they'd get them to the one finishing, you know, so. Sometimes it kind of got from there back to the mess hall, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah, right. Your adrenaline was going.
So
how long after the war ended did you stay there?
Oh, it wasn't but a short time, just a few days.
Just a few days?
Yeah.
And you?
And I was one of the first ones coming back.
Oh, okay.
Because I finished my missions and my orders already cut to come on back. So the radio operator and myself finished up about the same time we came back together. And they sent us down to Naples to a camp there, waiting to catch a boat to come back.
Oh, came back on a boat.
And they loaded us onto a old Liberty ship. You know what a Liberty ship was, that made specially during the war for carrying supplies back and forth.
Okay.
So from Naples we went down through the Mediterranean to Oran in North Africa, just right there at the Straits of Gibraltar, and a convoy assembled there, and I don't know how many, a whole bunch of boats together, and we stayed there about 1 or 2 days while that convoy was assembling. And then we left out, and it took us 21 days coming back. For every day going over, for every hour going over is a day coming back.
Oh, goodness.
And it got pretty monotonous on that boat. I'm glad to get back. And we were blacked out at night because all the submarines hadn't turned in. It's too soon after the war was over. So just off the coast of the United States, just about a day or two out, well, the first time that the lights were turned on the boats during the war, and the whole convoy was able to turn on the lights then. And we arrived back at Fort Patrick Henry at Newport News, and unloaded us off the boat there. And it was just about supper time, and they carried us in this big mess hall, and all the waiters on the mess hall was German POWs. And they gave us great big steaks and hot rolls, milk, buttermilk or sweet milk. The best meal we'd had in a year.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because we didn't have any fresh meat the whole time we was there, except Christmas we had some turkey. And I guess it was live turkey, I don't know. And anyhow, that was a real treat. And then they put us on troop trains.
Oh.
A whole bunch of different cars. And these guys were getting on different, you were assigned which car you're supposed to go.
Uh-huh.
And that troop train started down the east coast there, and it was at night. And all every once in a while, through these different towns, and all they'd drop off a car or two. Until we got down along Georgia then, wasn't very much of a train then. But got somewhere in Georgia, well, we got off and got on the regular Southern Pacific coming on east and west, you know, we came to Houston.
Okay. So were you discharged at that point, or did you still have some time to serve, or what?
We had, I believe, 30-day furlough, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to report back to Fort Sam Houston, and we went to Brooks, there in San Antonio for rehabilitation for 2 or 3 weeks. And that was just laying around the swimming pool, taking it easy, you know. And then we had orders, I got orders, so 2 or 3 more, to go to Ellington Field.
Oh, okay.
And I went to Ellington Field and stayed there a couple of weeks, and then got discharged at Ellington.
And came home to Livingston from
came
there.
Came home to Livingston.
You know, when we were talking with Mr. Grimes, he told us how much money he was paid. Do you remember what your...
I don't remember, but I was getting flying pay, extra pay for flying.
Oh, okay.
And so as long as you're on flying status, you got that extra pay.
Uh-huh.
But after I got back to the States and went to San Antonio somewhere, that's when I went off of flying pay, so then I just moved out.
Well, I just know that, especially like my grandson or my granddaughter, you know, if they were listening to this and heard that you made 33 cents an hour, you know, they would wonder how, and they don't have any concept that that was a lot of money. It meant something to us back then.
I paid more than what I needed over there because I sent back some.
Right, yeah.
And,
well, Mr. Kugler, I really appreciate you once again spending time with me. I found this really informative. I think that maybe it's time for us to close this part of our interview down, unless there is something else that's just burning on you to tell us.
I don't know of anything right now. Probably leave here and think of something.
Well, write it down, and we'll pick it up again sometime soon. But I really appreciate you. The rest of the world appreciates you and your service.
Well, thank you.
And appreciate your time sharing with us, and that we can preserve this part of our history.